नमस्ते, गुड मॉर्निंग, गुड इवनिंग एवरीवन। बिफोर वी बिगिन, आई वुड लाइक टू शेयर दैट वी आर प्लानिंग अ डे एंड अ हाफ इन शिरडी इन द बिगिनिंग ऑफ जुलाई। सो द डिटेल्स विल बी अवेलेबल सून for those who are interested to join us. I would like to begin by sharing a few passages from a book called Steps to Freedom and Mastery. There's a passage from The Mother of Pondicherry, which I would like to read out, and the book, which is a compilation by A.S. Dalal, a very sincere, revered sadhak, an explanation of that passage too. And as usual, after about 15 or 20 minutes, we can open the floor for any sharing or questions that you may have. So this is the passage, Mother's own words. The Supreme Consciousness gives to the individual in the active life of the world his sense of freedom and independence and initiative. These things in him are her pragmatic tools or devices, and it is through this machinery that the movements and issues planned and foreseen elsewhere are realized here. This is the passage, and I'll now read on. These things in him, that is, in the individual, are the sense of freedom, independence, and initiative. You know what independence is? It is precisely the freedom of choice. Independence means the freedom of choice, and initiative means the fact of choosing. First of all, one feels that one is free. And then one feels that no one can prevent him from choosing. And finally, one uses freedom to choose, and one decides. These are the three stages. So these three stages, the feeling that you are free, the idea that you are going to use your freedom for choosing, and then the choice. These three things I call the pragmatic tools and devices. If we did not have this illusion that we are free, this second illusion, that we can use our freedom from choosing, for choosing, sorry, and the third illusion of choosing, well, we would not move. So nature gives us these three illusions and makes us move, for she requires us to move. This is so clearly and beautifully said. And I would like to go on a bit. She with a capital S. I said it was the Supreme Consciousness, but in fact it is nature, and it is the trick of nature. For the Supreme Consciousness has no tricks. It is nature that has tricks. The Supreme Consciousness quite simply enters into all things with all her consciousness, because it is the consciousness. And with that, she tries to make all this inconscience move towards consciousness without any tricks. She has no need of tricks. She is everywhere. She is at work everywhere. And she puts consciousness into the inconscience. When you light a lamp in a dark room, as soon as you turn on the electricity, the room is no longer dark. As soon as you put consciousness in, there is no longer any unconsciousness. That is what she does. Wherever she sees unconsciousness, she tries to enter. Sometimes the doors are locked, then it takes a little more time. But sometimes the doors are open. Then she rushes in immediately. The unconsciousness disappears and consciousness comes. You see this eternal debate of free will and destiny will never end. What happens when someone has suffered in life, seen enough, and realized that things are not in their control? That the free will which they put up on a pedestal is not as venerated, as important as the individual me thought it was. And a teaching, a teacher mentions that there is a higher power. Then the individual comes to accept that this higher power is truly the one in control. I do not choose to breathe. Breathing happens. Blood is coursing through my veins. It happens. The earth I sit on is rotating at a tremendous speed and at the same time revolving around the sun. That too happens. In fact, I am sitting here by the force of gravity. So, how much is truly in my control? So, what happens is in this realm of duality, the polaric opposite of free will is now presented to the individual as God's will. And the individual now realizes, all I can do is my best in any given situation. The rest is up to God. So to get stuck on this debate of free will and destiny means we are still polarized. Ultimately, as the American mystic Joel Goldsmith would say, it is about rising above the pairs of opposites. The ego, with its sense of doership, the thinking mind, is mired and shuttles between the pairs of opposites, pleasure and pain, good and bad. And so on and so forth, between the extremes. But when this realm, this framework of duality is seen for what it is, which is just a mechanism in daily living, then, so to speak, one is no longer polarized and one rises above the pairs of opposites. This one could call the heavenly heart. The heart of consciousness, the heart of being. When we find that all concepts of hatred, malice, condemnation, blame, envy, jealousy, pride, arrogance, guilt, and shame when these drop away, we find that we are in fact immersed in conscious presence, which was always ever there. It was the thinking mind going into the dead past or an imaginary future, which somehow veiled this conscious presence. And what does it mean for us? That our practice, our sadhana, is in daily living, not restricted to 1 hour of meditation in the morning, a particular breathing technique. Our sadhana is how we deal with what life presents to us, our attitude to it, and our relationship with it, our relationship with others, our relationship with what happens in our life, pleasure or pain, and finally, our relationship with ourselves. You see, this is a point much stressed upon in these teachings, because if consciousness is truly all there is, the manifestation and the world as we know it is not apart from that consciousness. It is a reflection of that consciousness within itself. If it was apart from consciousness, apart from the source, then what would its origin be? Another source? So one has to be careful. There is a word very popular in non-dual circles, a term called spiritual bypassing. I would say that spiritual bypassing is to think one can attain Nirgun Brahman, the self, and still have inharmony, disharmony in daily living. That is not possible. Because if one is truly abiding in the self, there can be nothing apart from it. And so all relationships, as Goldsmith put it so beautifully, your neighbors are not the ones living next to you. What is closer to you is the content of your own consciousness, your relationship with it. These are the neighbors. So this point of relationships is hammered perhaps to the point of discomfort for the ego. One could say it is forced to look at these fundamentals. This is perhaps best demonstrated in Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi's actions, that when any prasad, any food was brought to him, he would insist that it is split equally amongst all present in his satsang. So this simplicity, this highest understanding, ancient wisdom, cannot exclude others, especially the ones you don't like, especially the ones who push your buttons the most. They, in fact, are your greatest teachers, bringing out what is buried deep within. And so the guru, by guru, I don't mean an individual. I mean the guru principle, sees this pure potential in every being to rediscover that presence, that beingness, which was there as a child, But then, with the development of the ego and its sense of separation, converted what was simply me and the other to me versus the other, and life became a battle to be won. My view versus your view, my way versus your way. Every time we find our peace of mind is disturbed, it is an opportunity to see why is it disturbed. And invariably, we will find that it is disturbed because of what we think others have done to us and what we have done to others. But when we start not only seeing but living this understanding that the hand of God blesses everyone, is behind everyone, we come to that statement made by Jesus to Pontius Pilate, "Thou could have no power over me except if it was given to thee from above." This is the satsang. This is the company of truth. Satsang is not just attending a satsang. Satsang is the company we keep. The company we keep closest to us, one on the manifest physical level, and two, the company we keep in our hearts and minds. This is summed up most beautifully in this line. I am reading this new book. Those who are immersed in Shirdi Sai Baba will find this book of tremendous value. It is available at cost price, I believe. A Jewel of Sai Devotion. And how Anna Sahib was so immersed in his love for Shirdi Sai Baba. So at the end, there are some pointers which Anna Sahib gives. And this I found very beautiful. Just as a new lamp can be lit from a burning lamp, one can experience Chaitanya in the company of Chaitanya. This is satsang. We know that if someone is in the company of addicted persons, he becomes like them. Similarly, Chaitanya directly affects your chetana, your consciousness. All right. If anyone would like to share anything or ask any question, they are welcome to now. My only request is that please be in a room where there are not too many background noises. And also please see that your If you are on the phone, that it is not shaking too much. And those who are in Mumbai, my request is to attend the satsangs in person rather than ask them on Zoom. All right. Yes, Sarah.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Gautam.
Hi.
So I have two questions for you, Gautam. The first is you spoke about disharmony, and I was just wondering what you meant by that. Is it that there might be a storm in your head, but your reaction to things, or to events is quite different from what you have in your mind? And the other question related to that is about how, when you start practicing or you start meditating and you're very new to it, it's not easy to control the mind right off the bat. So my own experience is that I'm at a stage where I I don't react to things the way that I used to. But I still have all of those negative thoughts in my head, you know. So I could be in a situation where I'm dealing with someone whose behavior has upset me. Now, I will not confront that person, but in my mind, I will continue to resent that person for a little bit. And I know that the idea is to change that way of thinking till we get to a point where we stop thinking altogether. Is there such a thing as in Advaita, as fake it till you make it, where you eventually get to a point where the mind just kind of, you know, starts to get the memo and get in line with the behavior?
Well, thank you for your questions, Sarah. Fake it till you make it won't take you too far. Because what is the point if be of being quiet on the outside while internally the churn is still going on? The churn of hatred and malice and condemnation and blame. And so this has to be really the head of Medusa with all its snakes has to be cut off. The understanding is what does this job. The understanding that nobody is the doer of their actions, that everyone's actions are based on two factors, their genetics and their conditioning, which God made. And these two factors, which one could call collectively one's nature, is the basis on which they think and act. It is this understanding which quietens down our own mind. When our own mind is quietened down, there is no room for resentment either. Whom will we resent if we have the full understanding that the one source is behind everyone? The one source is acting through everyone. Who will resent whom? We are resenting individuals. But when this understanding sinks into the heart, this whole quality of resentment will dissolve. We may yet find we have to take a decision and deal with this person. But now, what happens is rather than a reactive way of dealing with them, an unconscious way of action reaction, we find that we are responding. Because we are no longer targeting an individual, our guns are no longer trained at a me. This brings some level of neutrality and objectivity into the equation with the other. This is what happens. So, fake it till you make it is possible till a point. But what is the point of forcing yourself not to react or even finding yourself not reacting, but internally one's mind is not at peace? And this teaching is the dissolving of that mind which is not at peace, the thinking mind of the ego with its sense of doership. And coming to your first question, initially, yes, it is difficult to sit for meditation, but this happens because we seem to have a goal in meditation. If we just sit and witness the thoughts that arise without expecting any result, we will find that by and by it is getting easier and easier to sit. That is what happens. Therefore, I constantly say this: there is no such thing as a bad meditation. One could call a bad meditation one in which there are many thoughts arising, but then it begets the question, who was aware that there were so many thoughts arising? Who is that? Now, could you call it a bad meditation or a good meditation? Meditation in Advaita, in the parampara I belong to, is the witnessing of whatever arises as movements in consciousness. Witnessing whatever arises in the course of the day, what someone said, what someone did, an event that transpired, as simply a movement in consciousness. And not something happening to a me. If truly there was the understanding that consciousness is all there ever is, there is no room for even a thought to harm another. Because would consciousness harm itself? Which brings us to a very important point. Would consciousness love itself? It can't, because the nature of consciousness is love itself. Its nature is love. There is nothing apart from it. But this is not the dualistic love that we individuals are used to. This one could call a transcendental love. A love that is reflected as an acceptance, a total and complete acceptance of the other without any wish to change them, how we feel they should be, and how we feel they should behave.
Thank you, Gautam. That was very helpful. I was wondering if we're allowed a quick follow-up question because I understand that other people might be waiting in the queue.
If there is time, I'll certainly get back to you.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, Ganesh.
Namaste,
Namaste.
Guruji. So I just want to ask you, there is a difference between the practice of doing the what do you say meditation between Advaita Vedanta, the traditional Advaita Vedanta, Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. That's one thing. And also there is a I am finding it a bit difference between Nisargadatta's or Ramana Maharshi's Guruji's type of doing the meditation, and also the practical way, like Ramesh Balsekar and you, Guruji. So you are much more practical in the sense, third person related, like society related kind of a meditation kind of a thing. So how to merge and how to reconcile all these things and put into practice? That's my question.
Ganesh, please don't think about merging things. Choose that one which appeals to you the most. Because you see, these are all the same wisdom is presented in different ways, different strokes for different folks. So rather than getting confused and trying to amalgamate all three, if you feel you are drawn more to Bhagwan's meditation, Maharaj's meditation, whatever it may be, choose only that one. And dive deeply into that. It is so simple. Please do not merge and mix up these things. It is not needed. Does that help?
Yes, Guruji, thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
Nothing. Thank you.
It's a very rare opportunity to answer Ganesh's questions. All right, Ganesh, thank you. You see, asking is very important because one gets clarity that way. My teacher was very patient because he realized that spiritual seekers came with a lot of confusion because of a lot of accumulated concepts. Especially those who have been on a long journey, who have not been fortunate enough to be immersed in just one master, one teaching. So it is natural that the ego gets confused. And so he would encourage questions, unlike other teachers who would kind of say, don't ask too many questions. That was his way. Because he was pragmatic. He was studied in the London School of Economics. He was a bank manager. So he wanted dialogue and discussion till the confusion was cleared. All right. Would anyone else like to ask a question? I was yesterday with a young Sufi mystic who has kind of been authorized by his master to, in some way, continue the lineage. And he said something very beautiful. He said, we should not be concerned with getting, but giving. If we constantly focus on what we can give, the universe has no option but to give back to us. The me is always focused on getting. I want, be it something material or even be it liberation. I want. And so when the spotlight is moved away from the me onto the other, through various ways, just being with others, through charity, whatever it may be, then the me gets diminished, or one could say one starts getting unselfed. Without knowing it, the me is getting dissolved. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. That is why, in a course of Tibetan Buddhism I had studied, it is said, you only possess that which you give. Because after all, consciousness is giving consciousness. Yes, Ranko.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
All right, fine. Nice. My question is about consciousness. So, when I have this experience of just pure awareness in meditation, it tells me that everything arises in me, in this awareness. So, other people are just also arising in my consciousness, in my awareness. But that doesn't inform me that the other people has the same consciousness. I understand that some people have this experience of past lives and that they kind of understand that there are some other persons in past lives and things like that. So in that way they can understand that in the other person is the same consciousness. But that is not in my case. So if you maybe can have another idea how to see that.
We are only concerned with your case. You see, it's one thing about past lives and knowing all that, but it still comes down to, do I have peace and equanimity in daily living, right here, right now, in this present moment? Where do I stand? What the Buddha referred to as Sukha Shanti. Do I have true happiness? Uncaused, not dependent on others, on the material world, and not dependent on any identification. That is all we are concerned with. Why be concerned with what others say? You started very beautifully by saying that sometimes everything is seen in the light of pure awareness. So be it. So be it. And at times when we find we are involved in the blame game and doership, even that is witnessed. Even that is witnessed on the ground of pure awareness. I was involved. It is not judged because the ego is operating on decades of conditioning. It is so beautiful because it brings with it a deep, deep peace with what is. that truly even I am not a generator of the thoughts that arise in my mind. And so this consciousness starts revealing itself. One wants to be in this field of pure awareness all the time. That is earnestness. But it's going to take time to see things the new way, the new consciousness. One could say that the grooves, the old grooves, have to be reinscribed. New pathways have to be created by that one source consciousness, till by and by the new conditioning overrides the old conditioning, which one would call transformation. Transformation. The result of which is peace of mind.
Yeah, it seems that maybe it could be useful to see that consciousness is also in other people, so that we can see that God is even in them. That way, this relationship maybe would be harmonized more.
But in what way would you see that, Ranko? In what way? As I said recently, if you step out of your shoes and you see the other person is doing things precisely the way they are, bases their conditioning and their nature, it is so obvious. What else is there to see? That everyone is an instrument of God. What else is there to see? I really don't know.
So basically, I have to see it in my case, that I'm also destined, predestined, that my whole life is destiny. And then I can see that this is the case in the others. And probably that is enough.
In a way, yes, that I too know I am operating on the basis of my script, my blueprint, my genetics and conditioning. But make no mistake, this changes all the time. So let's say a teaching comes and infuses fresh conditioning into Ranko, and by Ranko finds that he is viewing the same situations and the same people in his life a different way. That is what is happening, because that is the destiny of Ranko. Destiny is not something which is dead, something which is fixed. Destiny, the most beautiful description of destiny is what is. Destiny is what is. Right here, right now. And so when Ranko finds by and by, as he navigates through the journey of life, he is finding he is no longer rattled like he used to be. He is no longer in conflict with what is. He finds he is more and more at peace. That is all there is. That is all there is. And he also finds that being more and more at peace, others tell him, hey, Ranko, there's a change. Or he finds new people come to him, want to be with him, have a cup of coffee with him. It can manifest in various ways. So the internal shift has taken place.
Yeah, I think I know what is the confusion. We kind of mix up destiny with our personal story.
Especially if we don't like our personal story.
And we think that we are destined by our personal story. So what happened until this time, it will happen probably at the same pace in the future.
Exactly.
That is the, yeah.
Exactly.
I understand.
You see, the me refuses to vacate its position in the story.
Yeah.
Incredible. This is the Maya.
Yeah.
That is why Siddharameshwar Maharaj said, Maya is me. Is there any simpler definition of Maya possible? It's fantastic. Thank you, Ranko. I enjoyed talking with you. Yes, Geeta.
Yeah. Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
I've been listening to your talks, thing more than a year now, and I find it so resonates with my way of thinking, what I'd been brought up with. And one thing what I would like to ask you is, what is your one liner for what you would like to give for the whole essence of your teaching?
I would be parroting my teacher's words, but I have no problem with that because that was my lived experience. It was, in fact, perhaps some of the last words he spoke. Love is the absence of separation, and separation is the absence of love. So, total and complete acceptance of others, of what is. Knowing that nobody is the doer of their actions, including myself.
Your teaching is basically like, it is giving a non-dual, I mean, existence with non-doership. So, like you often say, we are all babbling in air. So, and it is basically what I feel. I don't know, you just check me if I'm right. It is like Nididhyasana. It is practicing in daily living what you teach. What I get from your teachings is that it is more of practical implication, Nididhyasana.
Yes, you
So
could
that
say
is the
that.
beauty. It is the
Yes. Yeah.
beauty. Yeah, what I feel so peaceful. I mean, I've been reading so many books. I've been following so many teachers for past for many years, but when I heard you, and I could find so much of peace in your teaching. What I thought was basically what I was looking for, like it was Nididhyasana, like practicing in daily life and harmonious relationships. So like one liner would be to be one with the yourself, and with that awareness, dealing in day-to-day life.
Yes, you could say that, Gita, and that is why daily living is emphasized. The great master Sri Aurobindo emphasized. You see, he said meditation is all right, it's the inner work. But when you are into the karma yoga, dealing, working, engaged in the world, that is the testing ground. Then you
Absolutely.
know where you stand. And my teacher
Awesome.
would tell those who came to him, who perhaps had to understand this concept of nobody is the doer of their actions. The classic example he would give is, at the end of the day, choose any one event which you felt was your action and investigate it and really see whether it was your action or whether your action depended on something you saw, tasted, smelled, or touched, and then you called it my action. So he would give the example of someone seeing a blind lady standing on the footpath wanting to cross the road. And the lady is helped. This person goes and helps the lady cross. Then he says, you ask yourself, you think it was your action, I helped the lady cross the road. But if you had not seen the lady, the thought of helping her would not have arisen.
Absolutely.
So your action depended on something you saw. Secondly, your action depended on your nature. It was your nature to go and help the lady. Someone else may have walked past. So is it truly your action? Now, in daily living, when we start viewing the situations and people, family members, friends, colleagues at work, or the stranger on the road, Gita. And each situation, each person presents us this opportunity. That is called, as I said earlier, meditation in daily living. It is so beautiful. And you know what? Something else beautiful happens, which perhaps we were unconscious of earlier. We think twice before saying something which we know will upset others.
Absolutely.
Because peace is precious. Peace is so precious. We start realizing, am I taking away someone else's peace?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like it is not compromising with your peace. I mean, what my teacher used to say is living this Hindi mein usko bolte hai ki dvait mein rehte hue dvait ki hani na ho.
So, ah, that's very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
So it's lovely talking to you, Gautam.
To those who didn't understand Gita's reference of her teacher's words, it means living in this world of duality, may no harm come to non-duality. That's so beautiful.
And that has really, I mean, what I've grasped from all of his teaching. So that one liner, what I wanted to hear from you, like what I get from your teachings as well. I mean, what you try to explain. Thank you so much, Gautam.
Thank you for
so
sharing.
So wonderful. That.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, Vikrant. Sorry, Vikram. Vikram.
Hi, Gautam. I'm really enjoying your book, Heart to Heart, and it's really interesting. I'm at the section on Tibetan Buddhism, the eight bread that you're talking about today. So it's the timing is really interesting. So I've got two questions on your book, actually. One is a more smaller, but it's a wider question. I think you've had such an amazing spiritual journey over the last 25 years. And I feel like there is more that you can talk about your other parts in spiritual journey. So I was wondering why you don't do that often. And second is that I find a theme in your book, which is very much about you are being guided by intuition, that you have a vision or you have a strong sense to visit a particular place and you do it. So I've had some ideas about for next year, and some things are slow brewing, some things are gut feeling. So I just wanted to get your view on how do you get more attuned to intuition? Is it coming in your dreams? How do you get more the right signal from your higher self at the right times?
So yes, that's very beautiful that you pointed it out in Heart to Heart, because firstly, you see, people think, especially on the path of Advaita, that, oh, one should only be focused on the formless consciousness and so on and so forth. You know, little do they understand that the sages like Adi Shankara were the ones who established the most revered Devi temples in this land, because Shakti, Adi Shakti, cannot be ignored. It doesn't make sense. And so my endeavor to write about sacred places was just to guide people who are fond of making such pilgrimages and travels, caves and so on, because ultimately these sacred places also lead us within. It is another path. And so I thought perhaps it will be too much for people to expect or to understand that someone who speaks about Advaita could even write about this dimension. But I felt it needed to be shared. And regarding your question on intuition, it is really quite simple. When we find that there is not too much thinking about visiting a place, when we realize something someone said just appeals to us, wow, I would love to go there, without the mind trying to make sense of it, that is intuition. We all have it. It need not appear as a dream. It could appear as a sign that a thought comes about a place, someone else mentions the name the same day. We don't know how it works. But this thing is very important because the intuition is a mind in a sense which is not conditioned with too much left brain thinking, too much analyzing. So maybe a name comes to mind or a place, you hear about it, might be difficult to reach. You might say, oh, it doesn't make sense. Why have I thought of it? But deep down in your heart, you know it has pulled you. So here it is to just follow that intuition. It's really beautiful because the mind is too limited. It is too limited. We don't know really. And then thanks to this mind, we end up not going to places where intuitively we would have gone. It's easy to say, oh, even that was destined, of course. But this is the rasa of life. The juice of life is not to rely too heavily on the thinking mind. The mind, manomaya kosha. Then we have the vijnan maya kosha, the intellect. The mind has one limitation. One has to allow oneself the gift of intuition. So, for example, let's keep places aside. You are listening to three teachers speak. You will know for yourself whom you are intuitively drawn to, and that may not depend on what the person is saying. You may just feel you like this person more than the other. You see? It's really a liberating way to live life intuitively. Very beautiful.
Thank you very much. And I think the book is really interesting. As I said, I've been making a Google map of all the sacred places that you have visited, and hopefully at some stage I also go. And but it's really, really interesting. Thank you for sharing it.
But can you imagine if I write a volume 2? Then you'll be in trouble. Too many places to visit.
Thank you.
But I'm glad you're enjoying the book, and I enjoyed writing it. And I hope others enjoy it too, because it truly, the title Heart to Heart was inspired by a conversation between a Russian disciple called Irina Tweedy of the Sufi master Radha Mohan Lal. And she asked him for the definition of parampara, which means lineage. Parampara. And he replied saying it means heart to heart. She said, really? I thought parampara meant lineage. And he said, it's the same thing. What does this mean, Vikram? It's a heart-based teaching. All teachings ultimately are heart-based, one could say, living from the heart, which means not living from the split mind. There are different approaches. In Advaita itself, there are different ways. But this living from the heart is the heart of consciousness, the heart of awareness. The one heart, that is what it is. In the Sufi Naqshbandi tradition, Naqshbandi means the impressor. There's a very famous story of the founder, Hazrat Harun, who was so immersed in his love for his guru that he would forget doing any work. And he was very envied by his fellow students, because they knew that the master was very fond of this boy. And so this boy was given an instruction to paint the name of God, of Allah, on all the pots which were lying in the room. And the master left. And of course, Hazrat Harun was immersed in bliss and love and didn't do anything. So his fellow students were very happy, knowing that when the master would come back, he would be very disappointed with his star pupil. And the master came back and asked him, "Have you done what I asked you to do?" He said, "Yes." And the fellow students were even more happy because they said, "Now he has lied." And the master went into the room and saw that all the work was done. That is why it was called the impressor, impressed upon the heart. Naqshbandi. In this Naqshbandi tradition, it is largely a teaching in silence, but all teachings are teachings of the heart. The mind tries to catch up and make sense of it later. Of course, I remember my book Explosion of Love when I wrote it. The cover designer we hired thought it was a romance novel. So that might happen with Heart to Heart also. All right. Thank you, Vikram. Yes, Yuli.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, actually, I don't feel like asking a question, but I would just like to share that 2 days ago, I had another dream with you. And in that dream, you were on the streets inviting people to go to Shirdi because there was going to be a program. And near you, there was a big, very big poster of Sai Baba, no, Shirdi Sai Baba. But there were two images of Shirdi Sai Baba. They were the same images, but two with a big light. And you were, and now you started the meeting inviting us to Shirdi. What do you think? So
I think Baba is having a hearty laugh.
Baba will. Pardon?
I said Baba is having a hearty laugh.
Yeah. So beautiful.
Very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yes.
It means if he's appeared twice as two, then we are doubly blessed, you and me, and everyone here in the satsang. Just in case we miss the first blessing.
Maybe it appeared as two because I am a devotee of Satya Sai as well. And for us, they are one.
Could be.
But could be. I'll try to be there.
That's what I was going to ask. Where are you now?
I am at Puta Party.
I see. Great. If you can join us. I know it's very short, just a day and a half. It's probably two satsangs and one meditation. And of course, those who wish to go for darshan can go anytime. And there are also certain places which people don't know about, where Baba spent a lot of time. And we have someone who knows these places, so they can even visit those places.
I've never been to Shirdi. It will be a blessing, really.
Great. Let's see what Baba wills then.
Thank Great. You.
Thank you, Suli. If one really lives by intuition, then one would be surprised to find that we even love those we hate. Or rather, those who we think we hate. There was a very sweet Calvin and Hobbes comic strip I saw where Hobbes asks Calvin, "Do you believe in God?" And Calvin thinks a bit about it, and his answer is, "Well, I know somebody is out to get me." You see, this struck me very deeply. Somebody is out to get me. One is, when things go wrong in our lives, we feel that. What have I done to deserve this? Why does God punish me so much? Why does God trouble me so much? The ego has no end to the why questions. When the why questions dissolve, that somebody is out to get me is the same God, to hold you in the palm of his hand, that you have now seen the game of life, that I am all the chess pieces on the chessboard of life, the black and white chessboard of duality. I am behind the movement of the white, the movement of the black. I am the pawn, the bishop, the king, the queen, and the castle. I am the one behind it all. This is the game of life. And at the end of it, all the pieces will go back into the same box. So the problem is not duality, which is the framework of life and living, but dualism, where we get mired in this framework and choose one over the other. That is what happens. Yes, Sarah, we'll get back to you and close on that note. So go ahead.
Okay, so I have two questions now.
You always ask in pairs, is it?
I know, it's kind of difficult for me to choose. Brevity has never been a strong suit with me, but I'll try.
Okay.
So the actual follow-up question that I had was, if I find myself in a situation where there are certain relationships in my life that cause a lot of negative emotions, the kind of emotions that I am trying to get a grip on through my spiritual work, is it better to just detach from those relationships and those situations? Or is it a better approach to stay within them while trying to reform myself on the inside? And of course, I mean, this is all given the fact that I understand that it is a matter of destiny, who stays in your life and who leaves. And then the second question is about your response to Vikram's question. So when you say it is good to live by intuition, how do we make sure that our intuition isn't just us acting out our desires and our vasanas and our inclinations? So those are my two questions.
Your first question is the same question you asked earlier, but worded differently. What this teaching says is do precisely that which you think and feel you should do as far as a particular relationship is concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah, for example, if you just take it a bit extreme, if you were in an abusive relationship where you are being abused, it would mean you have to decide, do I have the option to step out of this abuse or not? And it doesn't mean suffering the abuse, you see. So we have to decide exactly what we think and feel we should do. How can you detach? Detachment is not detachment. Trying to detach is doership. It doesn't happen. Detachment is what happens when the relationship is seen in the light of understanding. Then it automatically happens. You cannot detach. The me cannot detach. It does not make sense. Detachment happens when I realize by and by this particular relationship has troubled me, and I start looking, what is the ground for that? Is it doership? What are the components? Detachment will automatically happen. You cannot detach and you cannot not react. These things happen when the control is given up and things are seen not for what they appear to be, but for what they are. And regarding your second question about intuition and desire, even the sage will work towards fulfilling his desire, knowing that whether it is fulfilled or not is God's will. And more importantly, will the desire harm someone or myself? This is in the awareness of the sage. The sage is an embodied being. A desire may arise, but the desire is not pursued to the detriment of others or oneself. And be very happy to answer your questions if more arise at the next Zoom. Where are you based?
I'm in rural Virginia.
Okay.
Rural Virginia, yes.
Okay, that's great. So
I'll be joining you for your trip to Siddhi.
Oh, how is that? Are you visiting India
no,
at the time?
I'm just kidding. Oh. I live in Virginia.
Okay.
And I am from Pakistan. I'm here for about a year and a half. And then I'm going to head back and figure out a way to sneak into India. I'm already sharing my illegal plans with all of you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Okay.
I hope I make it one day. If it's in my destiny.
Yes, if the intention is there, we wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
But you still have to book your ticket.
Oh, that I'll manage somehow. But the idea is to live in Thiruvannamalai.
All right. The mountain has drawn you.
Absolutely. The mountain and the man. So,
yes.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so Vikram, to end on one note, it just reminded me of something I wrote in the book, that it is intuition which took me to Ramana Maharshi's Samadhi as well as the Samadhis of Sri Aurobindo and the mother for 23 years, every year. And it's intuition which somehow I was not immersed in other aspects of Pondicherry, for example, activities in Auroville. There's lots to do there and lots to see, but I found I was just visiting the Samadhi. Now, it's not that I was having special experiences or going into Samadhi myself when I was sitting at the Samadhi, but I just wanted to be there and liked being there. So I would call that intuition, because for the thinking mind, there's no tangible benefit, right? I've not hit the lottery. I've not reached the highest states of Samadhi, but something within liked being there, and that was honored. So for me, I would call that intuition. When the mind steps in to weigh the pros and cons, then that is the thinking mind. Is it really worth it? Should I really spend that money? Should I really spend my time going there? That is when the mind is kicking in. All right, so I will now change the view so I can see all of you. We sit in silence for a minute or so. And if those who have their cameras off can switch them on, that would be a privilege for me to see them. Joel Goldsmith had a beautiful mantra, one could say. He would say, "Relax and feel the constant assurance of the presence and power of the illumined consciousness." The constant assurance of the presence and power of the illumined consciousness. Because the darkness of the ego, which is the ego with its sense of doership and the thinking mind, dissolves in that light. The ego cannot do the dissolving. It is the light that does it. Can the darkness make more light shine? Is it really possible? Or does light shine of itself? Thank you.